So again, good morning to everyone, those here in the hall and those at home online. It's good to be back. As many of you know, I've been away for a good part of June, July. We're in August now, right? June and July. So it's good to be back home. So I'm in a room. I could have said it's nice to see everybody's faces, but once again, we are not able to see each other's faces. So it was interesting in the last couple of days traveling back from North Carolina through rural parts of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia into North Florida. To see a fully masked up group is highly unusual. Just want to let you know that. This is a report from the outside world. We would stop in rest stops, convenience stores, restaurants, overnight at a hotel. Angie and I were traveling with our grandchildren. I would say it was we were some of the rare ones to be masked up. This is just the way things are. One of the main reasons we practice, one of the main supports the Dharma gives us is the ability to live in a world that we can't control, to live in a world that is primarily governed by the law of impermanence. Nothing is stable, everything is changing. To live in the world where that change is occurring according to causes and conditions, again, most of which are far beyond our individual control. So in the face of that, instability and permanence, and accepting that sickness, illness, disease is part of that mix. Certainly looking at the history of human beings, civilization so-called, epidemics, pandemics, wars, violence, climate changes, are part of the mix, isn't it? So how do we, I think our challenge is how do we live in the midst of this world that we cannot control? We cannot bend it to our will. We cannot make it what we want to think it should be. Right? How do we live with a mind that is peaceful, a mind that is stable, a mind that is open, a mind that is wise, a mind that is kind and compassionate, right? That's our challenge. So we have to find the middle way. And once again, we thought we were coming out of this pandemic, and now we are sort of masking up again, but because of, I think, the vaccination, hopefully we won't get back for many of us to where it was, even though for some people it is. Again, we have to find the middle way. The middle way is not the way of heedlessness. It's the world of sanity where we listen to the medical experts and implement their suggestions. But at the same time, we're not afraid. We don't hide unless we're told to. But fortunately, we are not there yet. So it's very important, as followers of the Mahayana Buddhism, the way of love and compassion, our attitude is always the higher good, the well-being of all. So, you know, we have to find that middle way, again, where we're not just listening to our thoughts. Many of us have thoughts that tend to go into fear, anxiety, worry, despair, depression. You know, that's the world of self. Looking out at the world and not happy that it can't control it, can't make it be the way we want it to be. Right. We want to live in the world of reality, the world of facts, and be able to deal with the world, again, in a way that is intelligent, wise, compassionate, and always for the greater good. Right. I happen to believe that coming together like this, even though we're masked, is for the greater good. So we don't feel isolated. We don't feel alone. We're in this together. As I say, until the instructions come down, everybody, you know, into their bunker, which again, fortunately, we are not there yet. There's no need to get into our personal bunker and turn away from our fellow human being. I mean, we are here for others. But I think you know all that. Anyhow, it's good to be back. And so in thinking about teaching today, lots of Dharma is available to us, lots of Dharma that is being taught over the years. But I felt like today, sort of coming back after sort of being gone for a couple of months, I wanted to go back to the basics. And there's no more basic Buddhist text than the Dhammapada, which I've referred to over the years. That was probably, you know, 50 years ago, probably the first Buddhist text I ever read. There weren't too many around those days. The Dhammapada is not a sutra of the Buddha. It's in the Pali canon, the earliest collection of teachings, but it's not a sutra. It's not purported to be a talk the Buddha gave. It's really a collection of his teachings in brief, like one sentence, two sentence. So it's really a compendium of the Buddha's Dharma, broken into chapters. So I'm starting with the first chapter, which is probably the most well-known on these 10 things. And there are many translations. As I've said before, it is very fascinating to compare translations. And while you see, yeah, they seem to be talking about the same thing, the emphasis is different, the terminology is different. So we always have to remember that that unless we're getting almost a word for word, character by character translation, which then doesn't read well, which loses the whole flavor of the verse, of the poetry, that's much more academic, but most translators are trying to put it into the vernacular that it could be understood. And that, of course, means making choices. So I think it's important that, you know, like in our community, we have these three paths that kind of develop out of each other, the mindful living path, the Dharma path, the wisdom path, but all of them participate in the basic Dharma, the basic truth of the Buddha's teachings of how to live in this world in harmony with things. In harmony with things means in harmony with everything. The good and the bad, the wanted and the unwanted. This is to live in harmony. To only live in harmony with what we want and to reject what we don't want is not living in harmony, right? To live in harmony with nature is to accept the full breadth of the seeming chaos of nature. And yet it is unfolding according to its own laws, its own causes and conditions. To live in harmony with nature, with the natural way, is to accept everything as it is and to be at one with it. In Chinese Buddhism, this is called the Tao, the way. Right? To be in harmony with people, in harmony with things, in harmony with the unfolding of situations, not to stand apart, not to accentuate the difference. And when we enter the harmony of life, which is not just, you know, the harmony of nature, but it's also of everything in our daily life and the people of our life and the situations we're in, can I not separate myself but enter into it fully? And within that fullness of acceptance and that fullness of living in life, I navigate it. It's not like I jump into the river and I, you know, take me wherever you want to go, right? You know, take me into the calm places, take me into the rapids, you know. No. In the river of life, we navigate, right? We make choices. We move this way or that way. But we accept we're in the river. We accept the reality of the river. We accept the reality of life. We accept the reality of the unfolding in the so-called external world and in our own internal world. We want to be in harmony. So, first verses. I have two different translations. Mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind wrought. So this is like, okay. This is a very clear statement of Dharma, you know, why it gives importance to the mind. This is where the Buddha begins, the mind. And mind states. So all our mind states, our good ones, our bad ones, our wanted ones, our unwanted ones, are all arising, proceeding from this mind. Right? None of that is permanent. Mind states aren't permanent. Thoughts aren't permanent. Right? But they are all coming from out of the mind. They are fashioned. They are conditioned by the mind. If with an impure mind a person speaks or acts, suffering follows them, like the wheel that follows the foot of the ox. The famous wheel of the ox cart. Probably now it'd be like of the car or something. Then everyone knew ox carts. Right? So in the same way that the ox is pulling the cart and the wheels just keep turning in the direction set by the ox, right? All our mind states and then our actions of body, speech, and mind follow from that. Mind is the chief. This is why mindfulness, we are the Florida community of mindfulness. Mindfulness, being aware of, being mindful of, you know, is our probably our most fundamental practice. And obviously what the Buddha is saying here, we need to be mindful, aware of our own minds, because this is what's conditioning our mind states, positive, negative, happy, unhappy, conditioning the way we speak, and the conditioning our actions. So if a person acts with an impure mind, suffering will follow. Like the wheel follows the foot of the ox. It's just a given. Then it says, second, mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They're all mind wrought. If with a pure mind a person speaks or acts, happiness follows them like their never departing shadow. So all of us, right? This is our choice. Right? And the choice begins in the mind. And the mind is a very private thing. each of us have our own mind, right? And each of us dwell within our minds, right? From morning till night, and even while we sleep, our dreams, they're unique to us, right? And they're conditioned by the past. So in this uniqueness of our own mind, we have to be mindful. We have to be self-aware. To be aware in the present moment, what am I cultivating right now? Just stop a second. Ask yourself, in the last 24 hours, have I been very consciously aware of the mind states that I've been cultivating? Let's all just stop and just ask ourselves that question. It's not only what thoughts pop up or mind states pop up, but then what do I do? Have I been aware? So when positive mind states pop up, I'm very conscious. These are what I want to cultivate. When negative, afflictive mind states rise up, very clear. I don't want to cultivate these. So just ask ourselves, am I practicing this? Whatever your criteria is. Where has my mind been the last 24 hours or the last week? Not just on the cushion, but in my daily life, in my daily activities. What is my mind cultivating? It's very important that we see there's a direct relationship between these mind states and the mind that's producing them and these thoughts and the way we are in life, the way we feel, the way we act, the way we relate, the way we perceive others, the whole deal. It's all going on in our minds. This is... This is the key place. And I'm speaking now to all the control freaks in the audience. This is where you have some degree of control. I mean, that's what the meditative practice is all about. How can I begin to gain control of my own mind? I'd love to control everybody else's minds. But, you know, they don't seem to go along. You know, they just don't seem to be very supportive of me controlling them, right? You know. I mean, of course, it's their loss. We know that. But yet, these are one of the things we have to accept. So at the end of the day, we are left with this fundamental insight. You know, the one thing that I have some degree of control over is my own mind, the action and my speech, and the actions of my body. So this is why I think, you know, this is a text with many, many, many verses, but this is the first one. I think it's very profound that this is where they start. It's very empowering. Right? It's not talking about deities outside ourselves. It's not talking about anything outside ourselves. Basically saying, you know, each of us has the capacity of knowing ourself. And that self-knowing, that self-awareness, that self-knowledge is the power that that we have to transform our own life and the life of those around us. Not like we can do it, but we can radiate a different kind of energy in our interactions with others. An energy that is constructive, an energy that is supportive, an energy that is positive. Right? Isn't this what the world needs? We all know that. Isn't this what our families need? Community, our colleagues. Right? So we are that person. He abused me, she struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. These who harbor such thoughts do not still their hatred. So, a little extreme. I would reinterpret it, much more daily life. Most of us on a daily basis are not dealing with people who abuse us, strike us, overpower us, and rob us. Right? But the message is the same. We all harbor anger and resentment to people. People that are close to us and people to who we just read about or hear about, right? We are angry at them for the way they are. We might even hate them. To hate someone is to really wish bad things for them. Those who harbor such thoughts do not still their hatred. I'm just going to put down anger, resentment. This is our great contradiction, isn't it? If we ask us, would we like to be free of anger? Would we like to be free of resentment? And most people would say, yeah, that'd be wonderful. Those mind states, they don't feel good, do they? And they sticky and they stay around and they pervert our relationships. And yet, what? We still harbor these thoughts, and we still cultivate them. So our anger will never be stilled. I mean, if we want to be free of our anger, then we have to still those kinds of mind states and thoughts that support them. They don't just happen by themselves. They have no legs. We give them the legs. She abused me, he struck me, she overpowered me, he robbed me. Those who do not harbor such thoughts will still their hatred, i.e. their anger, their resentment, their irritation, frustration. You know. Again, I think in our culture, the hatred thing is not predominant. We're sort of a couple of levels down. I think it's the anger, and the irritation and the frustration, that low-level stuff, which we cultivate most often. And as we cultivate it, we are just supporting it. We will wake up the next day with it. I mean, there's no way out of it other than to change. And so the Buddha is saying, those who harbor such thoughts will never still their hatred. Those who do not harbor such thoughts will still their hatred, anger, resentment, frustration, irritation. And then this, wonderful line, hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By non-hatred alone is anger, hatred appeased. This is an eternal law. So now he uses the word, the world. Wouldn't we love a world that would be free of violence? Most people say yes. A world where people don't hate each other. Groups don't hate each other. Countries don't hate each other. Religions don't hate each other. People of political persuasions and so, all philosophies. People hate each other. Right? It's so common these days. We're always so easily wanting to push people out because we're angry at them, because we don't agree with them. We want to push them out. We want to punish them, right? And that's across the board. But if we really want, you know, anger, hatred, violence to cease, then we have to what? As the Buddha said, by non-hatred alone is hatred appeased. This is the law eternal. So, I mean, the opposite of non-hatred would be what? A world where people love each other, where people care for each other, where people understand each other, where people accept each other. That's the world we want. So this is, again, you know, this clarion call of the Buddha, you know, that comes right down, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, you want a peaceful world, become a peaceful person. That's the way to create a peaceful world. Right? You want a world where people treat each other kindly, treat everybody kindly. You want a world where people are understanding and accepting of each other, then we have to be understanding and accepting of each other. I mean, strong words. This is an eternal law, right? So we have to reflect, is that, you know, if it's an eternal law, it means it's absolutely true. That hatred will never cease with more hatred. That violence will never cease with more love, with more violence. Violence only ends with nonviolence. Hatred only ends with love. We need to reflect, and not just like big, but very personal. Do I live that way? And not just how we look on the outside. Right? Do I live that way in my own mind, in the privacy of my own mind? Am I really working this one? When do we work it? Well, I mean, we can cultivate in a positive way, loving thoughts, kind thoughts, accepting thoughts, non-judgmental thoughts. You know, we can actively cultivate that. But if we really want to change, we also have to be very diligent on the other side. You know, when these negative mind states arise, when anger arises, when hatred arises, when, you know, irritation arises, when judgment arises, when all these things arise, do I practice? You see, what do I do then? See, that's where we change, right? Change means I go from this to that, you see. If we want to change, we have to change when that arises. We can't be waiting for the millennium, you know, when all of a sudden it's all going to be gone, right? I've been doing metta now nonstop for, you know, years. I've been saying over and over, may all beings be happy, may all beings be happy, may all beings be, you know, it's like, that's going on up here. Down here, not that one. May they suffer, right? I mean, I've even heard this kind of thing during this COVID thing, right? It's almost like, yeah, those people who didn't get vaccinated, good. Deserves them right, right? Maybe some of you have privately felt that. Yeah, they're getting what they deserve. We need to be very careful, don't we? People only change when they change. To wish ill for anyone is to acknowledge that others are allowed to think ill of us. Right? To be intolerant of others means that we are willing to let others be intolerant of us. I mean, are we the only ones who are allowed to to be intolerant, to wish ill for others? Because why? Because we feel justified, right? so do they. And therefore, it never ends. And then the next one says, there are those who do not realize that one day we must all die. But those who do realize this settle their quarrels. Very, you know, this is there. You see how simple these are? So, and also one of the reasons that this text is treasured because they can be memorized. Yeah. Right? Those who do not realize that one day we must all die. There are those who do not realize, but those who do realize this settle their quarrels. So death, and we know in Buddhism, we are very acknowledging of death, very accepting of death. We understand that's just part of the mix of being born is to die. And we, you know, while it's a surety that we're all going to die and that everyone's going to die, time, the time and place and the cause, that is what it's unknown. Those are the only unknowns. But you know, death is coming to all of us. But that awareness, I think, is a very important thing to remember. Because it puts things in perspective. You know, you may be very angry at this person. What are you going to do when they die? Can't be angry at them anymore. It's like just like that. I mean, you actually, people can stay angry at people who are dead, I should. But you know what I mean? It's all the quarrels we have with people. The misunderstandings we have with people that we cling to. And just think, I'm going to die. What am I holding on to? They're going to die. You know, I mean, this is, as the Buddha said, you know, I mean, he said it's the elephant in the jungle that because it has the biggest footprint. You know, we'd probably say in modern times, you know, death is the elephant in the living room, right? It's there. It is so life-changing. And yet nobody talks about it. Nobody acknowledges it. You know, if you're in a disagreement with somebody, if you're in an argument with somebody, and you go. Or whatever situation you're dealing with, difficulty, challenge, and you say to yourself, you know, I could die today. I could die tomorrow. Is this what I want to be? Is this what I want to be focused on? Is this how I want my mind to be? And oftentimes when you ask a question like that, you go, no. And that often then it's like you look at whatever you got caught in a very different perspective. So the meditation on death, the meditation on impermanence is very central as a reflection that wakes us up. You know, I mean, you know, in many ways it wakes us up, not just in the situation with another person, situation, but you know, like, what am I doing with my life? If this is going to go on forever, I don't have to ask that question, right? I can ask it next century, you know? I can wait a decade or two. But if I go, yeah. I mean, how many people have died during this pandemic? Millions worldwide, right? How many people 3 years ago, 2 years ago, thought that they're going to be were dealing with this? No one. And yet here it is. I mean, that's, again, that is the truth of this life. right? You pick up the papers with all this climate change going on, and the, you know, fires and drought, and you know, all this kind of stuff, which is happening all around the world. You go, well, people's lives are changing quickly. Things are happening. How can I use this to kind of wake up to what really is meaningful in life? There are those who do not realize that one day we must all die, but those who do realize this settle their quarrels. So please, if you're in a quarrel with somebody now, in a bad place with somebody now, family, friends, whatever, you know, go home and settle it. They're all impermanent. These quarrels, most of them are what? When we look back, what? Situational, petty. Right? Somebody didn't get their way. Something's not working out the way they want. Right? I mean, it's in the bigger picture, we'd have to go, it's petty stuff. And yet, if we're not careful, in the short run, our minds can fasten on them and elevate them, intensify them. That's why we want to have a mind that's free. That's not stuck. So please let us settle all our quarrels. We'll have time at the end for questions and discussion. Just as a storm throws down a weak tree, so does Mara. Mara is the in ancient India, Mara is the kind of representative, the symbol of delusion, the delusion of self. Remember, in the Buddha's life, when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, hell-bent on awakening, it was Mara who came in many ways through fear, trying to scare him, through seduction, trying to arouse desire, pleasure, through doubt. Mara appeared in the Buddha's mind trying to kind of dissuade him, get him off, distract him. Because Mara knew as the demon of delusion, that with awakening, with clear seeing, Mara loses all his or her power. So, Mara, self, self-centeredness, self-cherishing, is very antithetical to living an awakened life. It wants to keep us very well focused on the world and the pleasures of the world and the gain and loss of the world. So just as a storm throws down a weak tree, so does Mara overpower the person who lives in the pursuit of pleasures, who is uncontrolled in their senses, immoderate in eating, indolent, and dissipated. So we have to be careful. We might say, well, that's not me. If there's one thing I am not dissipated. And I'm not indolent. Sometimes I do. I am a little immoderate in my eating sometimes, but not generally. uncontrolled in the senses. What does that mean? We all have senses. We see, we smell, we hear, we have all of senses. Uncontrolled, which means we are monkey see, monkey do. Right? We're just looking, feeling, just grabbing, very distracted. Our sense experience is always pulling us this way and that. It doesn't mean we don't have sense experience. It doesn't mean the sense experience, to have sense experience is bad. It's not. It's very normal. It's very human. But it's uncontrolled. We're just lost in it, endlessly pursuing sensual experiences. And obviously, we are endlessly experiencing sensual experiences that are pleasurable, right? We're not pursuing, hopefully, sensual experiences that are unpleasurable. So it is this, this uncontrolled descendants, this living just for pleasure, etc. Endlessly indulging. He's calling. We are like a weak tree. So when the storms of life come through us, we're just knocked around. And many people find, why is it that, things get a little more intense or run into some kind of obstacle challenge or some kind of, I get so easily thrown off. I get easily swept away. I'm not rooted. Not rooted. It's because of this. Just as a storm cannot prevail against a rocky mountain, so Mara can never overpower someone who lives meditating on the impurities, who is controlled in their senses, moderate in eating, and filled with confidence and earnest effort. So this should feel good. Oh. Yeah, I know what it's like to be swept away by emotionality. I know what it's like to be swept away by my thoughts. I know how it's like to be swept away by fear or anger. I know what it's like to be swept away by desire and longing, to be swept away by dissatisfaction. I mean, I know how easily it is to be swept away. What can I do? Well, meditating on the impurities really means reflecting on these things that I find so attractive to see that fundamentally it's not like they're impure, like they're dirty or covered with manure. They're impure in the sense that they don't lead to pure mind states. They don't. A pure mind state is a mind that is happy, that is wholesome, that is that's in harmony, that's balanced. So that's a pure mind. Doesn't mean only have pure thoughts. Right? I mean, it's good to have pure thoughts, but it's not that extreme. Purity is like a mind of well-being. A pure mind is a mind that has been freed of a lot of the impurities, which means all these kinds of things that pull us. I don't live just for pleasure. I don't live just for gain. I don't live just for myself, selfishness. I'm not in this just for me. Right? My mind is pure. I see the needs of others. I'm concerned about the happiness of others. I don't want others to suffer. I don't want to suffer. I don't want others to suffer. I want to be happy. I want others to be happy. Right? That's a pure mind. So, a pure mind is strong. Because in the face of problems in life, one doesn't hunker down into self. But one is open and goes, what can I do in this situation? Can I see that the other person is suffering? Can I see the world is suffering? Can I see there are other people in need? And right when we turn our minds that way, the mind changes. The selfless mind. And we can feel it. when we're stuck in our own suffering, we become very absorbed in our own suffering and we can't see out of it. There is another way. Less self-concern, more other concerns. And the interesting thing is, if there's less self-concern and more other concern, the self feels better. Why? Because love, kindness, compassion, understanding, patience, these are pure mind states, meaning they create harmony in the mind. They create harmony in relations. Well, the other ones create disharmony, create conflict. So it is this paradox that when, as we become less selfish, less self-centered, we become happier, which is the opposite of the world. The world says what? Take care of yourself first, right? Get for yourself first, right? And then once you've gotten everything, then look around, you know? You know, it's like almost a thing, you know, in our society, we people say, especially people of means or whatever, well, now it's my time to give back, you see? But like, I had to spend 50 years accumulating, you see? And now that I've accumulated a lot, I want to give some back. This is not that. I mean, again, I'm happy people are giving back, even in, you know, for whatever reason. But this is right from the beginning in our life. When we maybe have very little material possessions or status, right? We can be giving to others. We can be open to others, caring to others, supporting of others, generous to others in any way we can to be helpful. And then the next ones are more for monastics. Talks about the monks. Whoever being depraved, devoid of self-control and truthfulness, should don the monk's robe or the nun's robe. They will surely not be worthy of the robe. So it's a very interesting thing that right then the Buddha is teaching, you know, just because you put on a yellow robe, you have the monastic robe, you are not worthy of it. If in your mind and your actions you still are depraved, devoid of self-control, truthfulness. But whoever is purged of depravity, well-established in virtues, and filled with self-control and truthfulness is indeed worthy of that robe. So that's very important, right? And I think that's very important that we hold, in this case it's monks, you know, monastics, but I would say we hold all people who hold themselves up as some kind of spiritual, religious leader of some kind, you know, we should be very attentive to their character and expect, as the Buddha expect, that they are actually living, right, what they are looking like outwardly, right? So, you know, it's not that hard if you're a good actor, if you've taken high school drama, right, it's not that hard to, you know, take on the role as what? A spiritual person. It's a role, right? I'll learn the words, I'll learn the look. You know, it's like learning your, if you like learning your lines. I don't know. Okay, I kind of get it. And so, you know, this is very wonderful that the Buddha, you know, right from the beginning, his instructions, you know, it's not about the yellow robe. It's not about the title. It's about your mind and how you are and how you act. So this is important for all of us. Those who mistake the unessential to be essential and the essential to be unessential, dwelling in wrong thoughts, never arrive at the essential. Those who know the essential to be the essential and the unessential to be the unessential, dwelling in right thoughts do arrive at the essential. A lot of essentials there. Translation. See, somebody else said, another translation, the deluded, imagining trivial things to be vital to life, follow their vain fancies and never attain highest knowledge. But the wise, knowing what is trivial and what is vital, set their thoughts on the supreme goal and attain the highest knowledge. So I like that one better. It's a little clear, that's what I'm saying. They're looking at the same exact words in Pali, but translating it very differently. You know, what is essential in this life? This is a very personal question, isn't it? What is really essential to me? What is the essential qualities of life for me? You know, we know about our physical bodies, right? I mean, it's interesting, right? Our physical bodies, what's essential to our physical bodies to maintain, physical well-being? We need what? Air, water, food, right? I mean, those are essential, right? Then it's nice to have what? Some shelter, get out of the cold. Anything else is essential to maintaining life? Okay, well, but that's a next level. Remember Maslow? Yeah. But I'm saying, if you look at what's essential, you go, yeah, essentially, I got to make sure I have water, air, and some food source, right? Right? And sleep, thank you, and sleep. All right, so there it is. That's basically an animal life, right? I mean, that's animals that live for what? They take care of the essential. Every day they get a, I mean, I'm not talking about our pets. they have another life. Talking about, an animal life, that's what their life is about, right? Taking care of the essentials. They're consumed with it. But they also have connection. Now we know some animals are very social and some animals aren't. Right, they're loners, they're predators, they find their own way. So again, we have a body, so we have, there are some essential needs for our body. But beyond that, what is essential to the quality of my life? I mean, these are very fundamental questions that, again, I'm just going quickly through this, that deserve reflection. Each of us, what's really essential to me? Essential means can't be done without, right? How much of my life do I spend focused on things that are unessential? Interesting question. Let's just stop a second. I think that's a good question. I'm going to ask that of Fred. So why don't we just stop? So if I ask myself, and let's just ask ourselves, what is really, what's the basic essential things that I need in my life? Physical, social. Mind, what's really essential? What are those aspects of my life that are really essential to me? The most essential means, this is the most important. The essential stuff nourish life, the same way like air, water, food, sleep. That's what we need to nurture the body, right? So the body is healthy. But what, in terms of my life, once I've met those essential needs, what do I need for my life? For my mind, for my heart, what's essential to me? Please just drop that question down and see what comes up. What is essential to me? And that could also be physically what's essential to me. How much do I really need? Does every child need their own bedroom? Is that essential? How many things do I need in my fridge and pantry to take care of my body? What's essential? What's really most important to me in this life? And then, of course, the question becomes, when I look at what I say is essential, most important to me, especially for my life, my mind, my heart, the question is, deluded, imagining trivial things to be vital to life, follow their vain fancies and never attain highest knowledge. But the wise, knowing what is trivial and what is vital, set their thoughts on the supreme goal, attain highest knowledge. Obviously, the Buddha has his own sense of what was essential, but I think each of us need to answer that question for ourselves. What's really essential to me, most meaningful, most purposeful in this life? And then, of course, you know, then we look at, you know, like he's asking there, but what do I, how do I spend, you know, like what's my mind consumed with all day? What am I doing? You know, and are they congruent? You know what I'm saying? If this is most essential, then as essentially I'm spending most of my energy, most of my life in supporting that which is essential. Or am I not? It's an interesting, it's a challenge to us. And we all have different circumstances. We all have different stages of life. I mean, we understand that. But it's important that we never lose sight of what's essential to us. What gives life real meaning? So we know that 5 minutes after we end this morning, those online can break into smaller groups and maybe talk about this. We also do that with people in the hall. We can break. Okay. I think this is a good discussion. But just for now, why don't I end the formal talk? If there are any questions, short comments, people in the hall, people online, people in the hall can just raise their hands. People at home can let Raylan know something they want to share. So again, any questions, any comments? The floor is open. Yes, the young man in their back. Can somebody give him a mic? Rob, can you give him a mic or somebody give him a mic?
So recently, I've had an opportunity to become aware of two things, mm-hmm. that I have spent a lot of time pursuing in the past, and you know, even in the recent past. And sometimes even now I catch myself getting caught in them. But one, basically a kind of competitiveness or status of wanting to be the best. And another one is in the intensive for MLP, we're studying the four nutriments and we're talking about edible foods. And I realized that I can have a lot of fixation on my body and getting it what I think it needs. So I appreciated you asking the question about physically, what do I need? Because I realized that, yeah, it can take so much of my mind space during the day, just thinking about getting enough to eat and will I have enough sleep and things like that. And obviously good to take care of your body, but it was just obsessive. Mm-hmm. And also with the status and like wanting to be the best thing, it's really interesting to reflect on that and whether it's really essential. Like, do I really need to be the best? Does that really make me happy? Mm-hmm. And what would it be like if I just let go of that? Like, what would my mm-hmm. relationships be like? It's really, when I can reflect in that way, right now a lot of it's just being mindful of it when it comes up, not acting on it. But it's very liberating to imagine that kind of different way.
Yeah, so thank you. So this is very, you know, again, we need to reflect. We need to reflect on our life. You know, this is, you know, we can't just, I mean, mind, to be mindful means to be aware of. And so we need to be mindful of these choices and these criteria in our life. I mean, that's essential to the practice, especially as lay people. You know, we're not living in caves. We're not, you know, devoting ourselves 14 hours a day to meditation. You know, we are actively in the world. Right. And the world is a conspiracy of superficiality. Okay. Is that clear? You know, I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, you know, this world is just honestly just trying to tell us, you know, pay attention to the, they don't even want us to think about what's essential. Right. Only think about how much more you can get, how much more status, how much more respect, how much more money, how much more fun, how much, you know, always want, you know, don't ask the deep questions. Right? So, yeah, it's good. It's good, you know, just to kind of, you know, it's not like neurotic, kind of like every day be challenging everything, but to kind of step back from our life and go, yeah, let me look at that. It seemed so right, you know what I mean? See, but now when I look back at it, yeah, what am I doing? Where is my mind during the day? What am I focused on? And are the things I'm focusing on really going to give me happiness? Like you say, you know, being the best of. Yeah, so let's say you win the match. Then it's over. What a disappointment, right? I can't stay in that sense of the best. You know, everything is temporary. So you realize, gee, if I'm always having to endlessly reaffirm because I never get any real satisfaction, what is satisfying? Is there another way of connecting with human beings that is not about, you know, winning or being the best or being most popular or, right? I mean, that's like junior high school, right? Some of us never grow up. We want to grow up. And the Dharma is one helpful way to help us grow up. And we see these parts of ourselves that are still immature. Now, again, because that's where we grew up. You know, it's funny, and then while I'll end, you know, I just spent really, even though I was with my grown children, I mean, a lot of the last couple of weeks have been with my grandchildren, right? And I realize to be with your grandchildren like in their world, is to enter a world where there's no Dharma. Right? They're just kids, you know, they're all about what? Me. It's like, I mean, it was just very interesting. I mean, it's like, yeah, they're all about me. And life is about, you know, getting their needs met. And when their needs are met, they are happy. When their needs aren't met, they're unhappy, right? And they're all, you know, they always want the food they want to have. They don't want the, you know what I mean? It's just like, I thought, wow. See, with kids, it's kind of, I don't know, you have a different way of looking at it. But I realized this is like the adult world, except they're just little, you see, and unformed. But this is most people. You know, there's no insight. You know, we understand they don't have insight. They are learning. So you're trying to help them gain some insight. But you realize, no, they're just in a world devoid of wisdom. They're children, right? And you think, wow, that's really not what's going on out here. Anyhow, just an observation. So thank you very much. It's good to be back sharing the Dharma with you. So please, again, think about the groups afterwards. I think there's a lot of rich material here to talk about. But I will be quiet. Thank you.